2D6, episode 21. Welcome to Roll 2D6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Roll 2D6 third quarter podcast.
Oh, man, is it Q3 already? It feels like just yesterday it was Q2.
Well, it is Q3, and that means it's time for yet another podcast.
Yippee!
As you may know, if you've seen the Roll2D6.com blog, we were both recently at KublaCon 2008, and we had a great time and played lots of games. And this year, I finally did something that I've been wanting to do for a while. I ran a couple of games at KublaCon.
All right. That was one of my favorite parts about KublaCon.
Yeah, and in fact, my wife came to the con, too, for the first time, and she even ran some games. So, a good time was had by all here.
That's right.
So let's get started and try to talk about all the games that we played and ran. And there's a lot of stuff here, so we'll go kind of fast.
Yeah. Before we begin, I just want to let the listener at home know that although we'll be talking about some of these games, some of them will deserve their own episode. And so we may not go into the kind of detail that we normally go into with each individual game, because we're saving those juicy morsels for later.
Sorry, that's a tease for the next episode.
Yes.
Okay. The convention takes place over Memorial Day weekend, Friday through Monday. So just go through day by day. The first game I played was on Friday. It was my lovely wife Jocelyn's game of Carcassonne. I think we did a podcast about that a while ago.
We did.
We mentioned earlier that she got me the Carcassonne Big Box for my birthday a couple of years ago. And that's the basic game plus four of the expansions. Actually, five of the expansions all in one box.
That is a big box.
It's a very large box. And Jocelyn and I play it together quite often. It's a good two-player game. So when I started telling Jocelyn about KublaCon, she looked online at the list of scheduled games and because she wanted to play Carcassonne if she went, and there was no one running it. So what do you always say, Nate, when someone complains that the game they want to play is not being run at KublaCon?
Sit down and shut up. Oh, no.
After you tell them that.
After I tell them that. Well, I tell them they should run the game.
That's right. And, it's like Gandhi said, be the change that you want to see in the world.
That is so profound. And it applies to playing games at KublaCon as
well.
That's
right. I don't know. I don't think he was really talking about games being run at a gaming convention. Well, but
he's
does
wiser
apply
than
here.
he knew.
That's right. So Jocelyn surprised me and signed up to run three games of Carcassonne. And another bonus here for both of us was that if you sign up to run 6 hours worth of games at KublaCon, you get your entrance fee waived. So both of us got to get in free for that because I'm running some games also, which I'll explain later.
Right, that to me is the second biggest. I want to say Benny. The second biggest thing that you get from running the game. First is you get to play the game you want to play.
That's right. That is
second
a big
is
thing.
That you don't have to pay for the privilege of playing the game you want to play.
That's right. And you get to run it with all the expansions you want and all that.
That's right. All your own home rules. You can make people. You can bend people to your will.
It's true. And you can even put it at the exact time that you want, too. So that's
exactly.
Great. So Jocelyn likes using two expansions on Carcassonne, Inns and Cathedrals and Traders and Builders. Actually, and the River, which we always use. I forget that that's actually an expansion. But
it is. It's but every game I've ever seen, people are like, oh, yeah, and the River. And
so we do use all three of those usually. And one of the advantages, like I said, of running the game yourself is you get to decide what expansion sets are going to be used. And so she put those two, Inns and Cathedrals and Traders and Builders, in the event description. So on Friday afternoon, I went and played in her game, and we had a good time. There was six of us playing in all, she and I and four other players. And that's fun. I don't usually get to play in a Carcassonne game that big. And let me tell you, it's very different than the two-player game.
Right.
You're basically playing only a third of the tiles that you're going to play in the two-player game. You know, I know when I'm playing the two-player game with Jocelyn, and we play mm-hmm. with all these expansions, so there's a large number of tiles, I need a particular piece. I need, like, one of the little turns or something.
You're always doing tile counting, I bet. You're sitting there, there are seven of those bends,
that's
and there
right.
are only two out on the table.
There's a tile distribution chart it comes with. And,
exactly.
You know, you look at that, and you're like, oh, there's three of that left. There's
they
two
kick
of us
you out
playing.
Of a Vegas cathedral for that. Or, not cathedral, Carcassonne game.
If they played that at Vegas, I would be there more often. But you can look and say there's three of this particular tile left, there's two of us playing, there's a really good chance I'm going to get at least one of those. But with six players, you know, all bets are off. You really cannot count on any pieces coming to you that you want. Right. Even the one piece where there's like nine of it, you know, there's still a good chance you won't get any. So it's a very different game that way, and every piece becomes so much more precious, and you have to really think you can't afford to make any mistakes.
Yes.
Anyway, that was a great game. So after this, we had lunch, and then brought about all my stuff in from the car to set up for the game that I was running in the afternoon, which was a game called Gutshot.
I want to remind the listeners, for those that have listened to the other KublaCon podcast, that last year you went on an Old West kick, and that has continued for the entire calendar year. you've been building set pieces and buying Old West games,
I'm almost
thinking you're going to start dressing like a cowboy at this point. You'll have
now, hold on there,
chaps.
Hold on there, partner. My chaps are not back from the shop yet. having them let out. Gutshot is a... to get back to that.
You're running Gutshot.
Gutshot. So this is a game that just came out in 2006, I think. It's from Hogleg Publishing. And this is a fast-moving Old West shoot-em-up game. Picked up a few months ago and actually bought it online, and the designer of the game signed it for me, which is nice. This is a great game to run at conventions, or so it would seem. The rules are very simple. The games are dramatic, and with the right terrain and miniatures, which I tried to have for this game, you can have a very cinematic experience. So I made a whole bunch of papercraft Old West buildings. Got some obstacles for cover, little crates and things for people to hide behind, and some because I'm not so good at painting miniatures, and actually, to tell you the truth, I'm lazy and don't want to paint hundreds of little miniatures. I got some very nice cardstock
triangular
miniatures.
We made no secret of this, by the way.
That's right. We haven't hidden the fact.
We have not hidden that. So what did you use again? I spoke over.
So these were cardstock miniatures, triangular cardstock miniatures that had a top that I could put the symbol for each player on, which really worked out well for Gutshot. And if you look on the pictures on the Roll2D6 Flickr account, you'll see what I mean.
And you bought those cardstock miniatures from one of these places like RPG Net or something like that?
Yeah, it RPG was from Now RPG or... Now. Yeah, there were some cardstock Old West miniatures. And when I do the Gutshot podcast, I'll explain all the stuff I did. So I'm saving that for the future.
Oh, yeah. A tidbit. Juicy tidbit.
That's right. But it was a fun game. I had a good time running it. The effect of the whole town was really nice.
It was.
But
I played in that game.
You did. And how long did you last?
I don't like to think of it in terms of number of turns. I like to think of it in amount of enjoyment. And I had a tremendous amount of enjoyment being the first casualty on the table and the first person out of the 12-person game.
Well, someone had to be the first, so thanks for...
in my own defense.
Yes.
Okay, and this is me trying to salvage what little bit of... honor that I have. I was being double-teamed by a mother-son team. You know, it
That's
was
right.
Everyone for themselves, but these two, in real life, a mother and a son, decided that they were on the same team.
Yes, they were not supposed to do that.
Right, and so even though they were like 2 inches from each other, rather than attacking each other, they were both shooting farther down the street at me.
Yeah, so and, that was a little unfair, but you know.
It was, but if it was going to happen to anybody at the table, I'm glad it was me and that everyone else had a good time as well. I had a good time, but I can't guarantee that other people have a good time being double-teamed and taken out in the first few
One of those two ended up winning the game, actually. It got down to those two, and then one of them killed the other.
Because they weren't shooting at each other the whole time. They were both in cahoots at one end of the street for the whole time.
It's true. So anyway, we'll talk more about that game in a future podcast. But I will say, however, about this, that I'd forgotten how draining, you know, mentally draining, I suppose, it can be to run a game at a big convention like this. We were in the big miniatures room, which is a big hotel ballroom, and it gets very loud in there. At least it was very loud on Friday night.
Yes.
And I had to speak up as loud as I could. Now, you know, I'm pretty soft-spoken. That was...
We have your microphone gain turned up incredibly loud just so people can hear you.
It's hard for me just to speak
You're
up throughout the course of a podcast.
For the deaf sometimes.
I need a closed captioner to follow me around.
That's right.
But so I'm pretty soft-spoken. That was hard for me to keep my voice at that level for the whole game. And it also didn't help that a few people in the game were not really buying into it. And they weren't entirely happy with the rules and the fact that they were missing a lot and stuff like that. you know, the fact is that people are running around a lot. Their characters are running around a lot in the game and trying to shoot at each other. And in Gutshot, I know I said I wasn't going to get into the rules, but in Gutshot, if you're running while shooting a pistol, it's going to be hard to hit someone, right, just like in real life. I mean,
exactly.
When you know, when you shoot someone, you want to be standing still.
Well, see, but for other miniatures games, there's a move and shoot. And for the most part, it doesn't matter if you move. Yeah. You don't have any penalties for when you shoot. And the problem was is they were all trying to move around at their highest speed. And still not have a penalty for it. And it was just, they just didn't understand how difficult it is to aim while running. Because other miniatures games have led them to believe that it's really easy.
Some of them don't give you that huge penalty. Yeah, in Gutshot, if you're running while shooting, it's hard to hit. And if your target is running, it's hard to hit. And so, anyway, the game seemed to be kind of a hard sell for a couple players. And that made it a little difficult for me.
Right. I wish they would have died before me.
I should have made them the target.
There you go.
But anyway, my voice was shot for the whole rest of the day and even part of the next day from having to speak so loudly for so long. And you probably remember my voice just being gone.
Yes, you were all hoarse and gone for most of the day.
I had a frog in my throat for the rest of the day. My second game of Gutshot went much better, but I'll get to that later. So after Gutshot, we played the first of what would be three homebrew games that are created by Daniel George of August Games, which is pretty much just him and his private game company.
It's him as his private game company and his color printer.
That's right.
Laminator.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. These were great games. And
they
I had
were.
A lot of
they
fun.
Were really good games.
So the first one we played was Roadkill Rally. And I think I played this one in 2004 also, when I was at KublaCon then. In this game, all the players control one car. You have a variety of weapons and gadgets, and you try to complete a Death Race 2000-style race from the start to the finish of a two-lane highway. The highway sections are drawn at random, so every racetrack is different. When someone gets to the end of one road, you draw a card, and it could be a tight bend or a straightaway or a tight bend to the other side or a not-so-tight bend.
Right.
Every racetrack is different that way, and the track is also littered with debris, and there's pedestrians, which you can run over for points.
You gotta love a game that encourages killing innocent.
That's right. And you get more points for children and senior citizens.
That's right.
And then there's lots of fun weapons and gadgets the cars have. It's a fast-paced, action-packed game. And
I just want to share my favorite gadget.
Oh, yes, what was your gadget?
The harpoon parachute.
Oh, yeah.
Is you could fire it at somebody, and it would harpoon their car and then deploy a parachute to slow them down. And that just seemed so incredibly absurd, yet incredibly useful. I really enjoyed using it.
It was really great, because speed is very important in this game. If you can get ahead of someone, you can really block off the road for them.
Yes.
Some of the cars he had were optimized for speed. Some were optimized for shooting at other cars. Some for ramming other cars, things like that. And each one plays a little differently. So we had a lot of fun with it. It's not like Car Wars, where every car has lots of ammunition and everything. Most of the vehicles had only just a couple shots from their primary weapon.
Right.
I had the one car that had a lot of shots, and I probably had like 7 shots total from my various weapons. Most people had 2 or 3 shots. So there's a lot of ramming, and you save your shots for that perfect moment. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. And the next game we played was the next day, and this was another game by Daniel George called War of Sail. And I think this game really scratched your Age of Sail naval combat itch. Isn't that right, Nate?
Yes, it did. I want to step back just a second and talk a little bit about the history of my desire to play naval combat, Age of Sail, naval combat, Napoleonic, or so forth.
Briefly, what is Age of Sail defined as?
I wish I would have looked up that definition before you asked me that question.
I just thought you would know that off the top of your head.
Well, essentially off the top of my head.
17th, 18th centuries.
It is 18th century. 18th century naval combat during the rise of the great naval powers. So Great Britain, Spain, France. They're all sail powered.
You're talking wooden ships, cannons.
Square sails, cannons. So, you know, think pirate, but not pirates, you know? So,
sure.
But not early pirate, like exploration of the New World, but later. Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander series.
Right, okay.
So the Aubrey Maturin series, if anybody here reads those books, it's that sort of time.
Okay.
So I have for a while now wanted to play a game like this, and because I wanted to play a game and I didn't have one, I actually went out and got the Patrick O'Brien Aubrey Maturin series, the Master and Commander books, and started reading them in the hopes of having that scratch my naval combat itch, and it actually just made it worse. It made me want to design my own game, and I'm like, oh, it'll be great. I'll have the people use
We had several discussions about how you would design this game.
Exactly. We had many discussions on how I was designing it. I made notes. I started preliminary design, all sorts of great stuff. And the good part about this is essentially Daniel George designed my game and produced it without ever talking to me about it. So I was pretty pleased.
Had all the things in it that you were looking for?
It did. It had the things that I was... It had sort of... I mean, it took into account wind, but it wasn't incredibly slavish to wind. It also took into account crew usage, so that you needed a certain amount of crew, and as crew people died, then the ship didn't move or shoot as well. And also, there were the physical aspects of the ship. It took into account different kinds of shot, chain shot, grape shot, round shot, all sorts of things. It was at the same scale that I wanted to do. I didn't want to do a whole fleet, but maybe one or two ships per person. So really the close-in combat of the Aubrey Matron series of the books, where it's, mm-hmm. you know, one scrappy captain against another, or maybe two on two or something.
Right, And in the game that we played, it was six players, three on three, and each player was controlling two ships. So it was six ships against six ships, isn't that right?
Yes.
So that was a nice 12-ship battle that was a decent enough size that you were looking for?
Yeah, it was. It was a really good size. And so in general, the game, it had all of the... Now, granted, maybe I would have done it a little differently or done the mechanics and conflict resolution slightly differently, but that to me it was not as important as the fact that he took into account some of the things that I thought were necessary to really capture the feeling of Napoleonic era, Age of Sail, naval combat.
Cool.
So it was really good that way. I recommend his game. It would be well worth playing.
And I think it is available on his website, but I'm not sure.
If it is, we will put a link to it in the show
yes.
notes. So
when I talked to him there, he said he was cleaning it up to get it up there. So it may not be up there now, but if not, it will be there at some point.
Yeah, he probably has some contact information. You can harass him.
Yeah.
Ask him when it is it's going to be up there. One of the other great mechanics that I really liked about the game was the simultaneous action selection mechanic.
Ah, yes. I always love that in every game.
I know. Every time we play a game that has that, there's a little glint of glee in Adam's eyes. He's, ooh, I simultaneous action selection. Yeah.
That's exactly how I sound.
That's what the glee looks like.
Oh, that's the sound of the glint.
That's the sound of the glee. But so you essentially take three turns worth of maneuvering, and it's pretty good. I enjoyed it because it allowed a lot of interesting results.
You say,
I'm cutting a hard left. Oh, but I'm cutting a hard right. And you end up ramming into each other and fouling. It was really nice that way. And it sort of replicates, in a way, the fact that in that age, there were no radios, and you can't coordinate. You can't take everybody and say, well, we're all going to move in perfect formation this way.
Yeah. I mean, the most you could do was run up some signal flags that gave a very brief and vague message to other ships in the fleet. And just running up those flags takes, 10 minutes or whatever.
In my game design, I was actually taking into account some of the signal flags. I was looking them up and saying, well, which one means I'm heading port? Which ones mean starboard? Yada, yada. And what was really good about simultaneous action selection is it sort of is like, well, for the next little bit, we're just all on our own searching really hard to figure out what our comrades are doing. And we're looking to see which way they're going and trying to make assumptions as to where they might be going. And so it was really good. I kind of like that. The other thing that I liked was the crew allocation.
Yeah.
One of the things that comes through in the genre is that people... in spite of the fact that the ship's moved by wind, the people really are the engine of the entire ship.
Right.
And they, they run the ship, direction, speed, weapons, boarding actions, so essentially how good your ship is when it's up close as opposed to far away. They are the, quite literally, the lifeblood of the ship.
telling me about this, and if you want to change the direction of the sails, it takes guys to pull in ropes or let out ropes.
Right.
If you want to raise or lower the anchor, if you want to... Yeah, anything you want to do other than just sail straight ahead.
Right. Anything that you want to do has to have human power behind it allocated to it. And so we had to allocate people to do different things. And I thought that was great. I really enjoyed that.
And it was neat because you had, at the beginning, I think that you have enough crew to do pretty much everything on the boat, right?
Right.
And then
couple left over for Marines or something.
Yeah, and then as you start to take damage, it starts to become a more difficult decision. Do I put some guys on sail so I can turn, or do I put them on cannon so I can shoot, or do I put them on repair so I can repair that hull point I lost last time?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I really like that. There's only one mechanic that I had come up with that he didn't implement, and that was the effect of officers.
Oh, yeah.
I had a whole interesting idea for officers and non-commissioned officers and all sorts of things like that. And he didn't have that. Crew was crew. But as far as just simplifying crew allocation, it worked great. One of the other games that it sort of reminded me of was Sky Galleons of Mars.
Oh, yeah.
And the Sky Galleons of Mars was also very much like an an Age of Sail, but in fact it was more like a steam age.
That's right. That was where you had basically ship combat, but the ships were flying ships because they had the levitating Martian wood or
lift
something.
Liftwood, yes.
Liftwood. And you had various crew members that you could assign, some of them to the propellers, right, and some of them to the cannons, and some to marines or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you could switch the roles around as needed.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, that's the way it went. And so it kind of reminded me of that, and I knew you had to have some sort of crew allocation there, and as you took damage, you had less to allocate to do that sort of stuff. So it was pretty good. I really enjoyed the game. I thought it was worth taking a look at.
Cool. Yeah, we should try to find those rules. Maybe we can play it again. And we'll add,
I don't know,
your...
there was a lot of stuff to print up and create there. He had just tons of cards and all sorts of other stuff that I'm not sure I want to replicate.
Well, we'll find a
color
printer
somewhere. But I'll
sign up next
year when he runs it.
we need to take his game and modify it to add your officer rules.
Oh, there you go.
Because, nothing is good enough. We have to add our own flavor to it.
That's right. We can't let anything lie.
That's right. This is the way true gamers are. Every time I finish a game, I'm like, let me try a variant now.
That's right.
Let me make something up. I can't leave well enough alone.
That's true.
All right, so Age of Sail, that was a great game.
Yes.
The last game that we played that day, I think this was that same day,
was
Man of War.
Yes, Man of War.
And we both really liked this game, I think. This is a discontinued Games Workshop game. Is there any other kind? In which all the familiar...
It's called Planned Obsolescence.
That's right. All the familiar races of the Warhammer Fantasy universe decide to get on boats and do some naval combat against each other.
All right. So we had an entire, naval afternoon and evening, which was
fun. Right. So each of the races has its own distinctive fleet of ships that they all work differently. So, for example, I had the Chaos Dwarf fleet. My ships were steam-powered ironclads. I could move in any direction without worrying about the wind, but they all moved pretty slowly. I had a couple of large ships with big long-range guns and two squadrons of ram ships, three of each, two different types. And one of these even had the big spiked cylinder on the front, so that's right, they took the Dwarven Death Roller from Blood Bowl
and
made it into a ship. It was great.
I bet the Dwarven Death Roller was also in Warhammer Fantasy, but...
It was.
We're familiar with it from Blood Bowl for the most part.
Yes, I am. Yeah, that's the only thing I know it from. I had that miniature, actually. That
was, yes, you did.
I remember painting bloodstains onto the steamroller.
Yeah, you made it dried bloody, but I remember this is way too complicated.
I had different colors of blood. Yeah, it was great. I was mixing the colors. Oh, those were the day. Anyway, in Man of War, so I had the Chaos Dwarf fleet. My principal enemy in the game, who was sitting right across from me, was the Dwarf fleet. And they also had ironclads, but they had some dreadnought-type battleships with gun turrets, and they also had a couple of submersibles, which were pretty cool. They could submerge for one turn at a time, and while underwater, they couldn't be attacked, and they could fire a torpedo. So what kind of fleet did you have, and who did you engage in battle?
Well, the table was huge, and the ocean that we were fighting in was enormous, so I never actually made it to your side of the
table.
That's
right. If you look at the pictures on Flickr, you'll see that it's a humongous map, and so the two dwarf fleets, the Chaos Dwarf and the regular dwarf, were on one end, and then you and the other two or three fleets were on the way on the other.
We were way on the other side, and there was one guy right in the middle who spent half his time heading one direction and deciding, well, I don't want to go into that battle, so he turned around and went the other way. He spent all of his time traveling across the board and never actually anything.
So who did
I
you
had
have?
The Chaos Human fleet, so we were a bunch of sort of demon-worshipping, blood-soaked, slave galleon-driving ships.
Worshipping the demon Khorne.
Yes, the demon Khorne. As a matter of fact, I did. I had the hammer of, I had Khorne's hammer and all sorts of fun stuff.
Right.
I had, my ships had both oars and sails, so I could go slowly any direction, or I could go with the wind fairly fast. Some of them were, had regular sorts of cannons. One of them had cannons that threw like hellfire,
sort
of magical skulls.
Like flaming skulls.
Flaming skulls and things. That was great color. I liked that. It's one of the reasons why I picked the Chaos Humans. I thought it'd be fun to do that. And the last kind of ships were shark-headed ships that they don't have any distance weapons, but they run right up into your against the other ships, and they don't ram them. They just crunch on them. They munch them.
Oh, okay.
And so they did damage being in contact, but it wasn't like ramming damage.
Okay.
So we were over in the corner. It was the Chaos Humans, and nearby were the Bretonians, which looked exactly like, 16th century, 17th century British ships.
Okay.
So right across. They were square sail, wooden-sided cannons. They had broadsides. It was like fighting the English.
Yep.
And so they were the ones closest to me, and they came to poke a fight at me. We also had a couple of neutral fleets around that the Games Master was controlling. It were pirate fleets.
There were some pirate fleets. And those guys, I think he gave each of us a certain amount of gold, and if you were within a certain range of the pirate fleets, you could bribe them. And so for that turn, the pirate fleets would attack whoever you asked them to.
Right, right.
And that worked out. That was pretty fun because the pirates were switching sides fairly often, I think.
Exactly. For whoever wanted to pay them more money, they could switch sides. It was pretty nice. So I fought the Bretonians over on that side. I wanted to go over to your side because some of our victory conditions for victory points would have been better served for me to go pick on the dwarves rather than pick on the Bretonians, but yeah, they were catching up with me fairly quickly, and I wasn't able to get over there to your side because it was taking frickin' forever to get over there. I turned around and decided to confront the Bretonians.
I think the Bretonians were faster than you on wind power, right?
Absolutely. They were totally faster than me. Their guys had...
had sail only, right?
9 inches so movement, sail only, and I had 6 inches of movement. And they had the wind at their back. The wind happened to be coming in from their corner, so it was like they were just zipping along and coming right up on me. And I was like, I'm not going to make it up there. I may as well do that.
But yeah, well, that's good.
It was nice. We had, demon cultists fighting essentially, Great Britain in some way.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. My side of the table had a good time.
Oh, and what about your one flying ship you had?
Oh, I had one who was Winged Terror.
Yeah, the Winged Terror.
It was a Winged Terror. It was a flying ship that it was a biological. So it generated a certain amount of energy every turn, and I could use that for movement or damage,
or
healing itself or whatnot. And it was really cool because if I pumped it into movement, I could cross the entire board, but then I had no weapons. And if I put it all in weapons, he just sort of sat there. He couldn't move.
but he could sort of repair himself.
But he could repair himself. So every once in a while, somebody would take a poke at him. He'd get a little bit hit, and he'd say, "Oh, I'll just move half as fast and repair myself." And it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I liked that particular, the Winged Terror. I just wish it did more terrifying things other than just throw damage occasionally. I wish it had some sort of great fear spell or something.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I kept trying to make people afraid of it. Like, be afraid of the Winged Terror! And the Bretonian guy.
Yeah, they weren't buying into it, huh?
The Imperial, they didn't buy it. He was like, "Oh yeah, that's terrifying. I shoot at it."
Yeah, well, I really liked this game. It had a lot of flavor, if you like the Warhammer universe.
Yeah.
We both used to, as we've said, we both really used to be into Blood Bowl, so it reminded me a lot of those times. There was also a Norse and a Skaven fleet that he had set up, but we didn't have enough players, so those were not used.
Right.
So could have had Berserkers.
We could have Berserkers
Viking
and longships. Skaven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Skaven with their giant bell.
Yeah, the Bell
that
of Doom,
weird.
That's
the
right.
The Bell of Doom on the Skaven ships.
The damage system was pretty quick, and it worked well, so each ship had something like 4 to 10 damage locations that you mark on a card, and if you got hit in the same spot twice, you had to make them a critical hit roll, which could then cause extra damage. And then you also had some below-the-waterline hull hits on each ship. Those are tracked separately. You usually only had a few of those, like the small ships only had one of those. And luckily, those below-the-waterline points couldn't be damaged by gunfire, but they could be by rams and by those pesky aforementioned dwarf torpedoes, which sank my big gunship.
I wasn't incredibly fond of the damage resolution system.
Yeah.
I mean, it was simple and fairly fast, but I just thought it was just a little too wonky. Because you had to make your roll to hit, and then you do your roll to hit, and then you had a roll to save against the hit, and then you may have some other mechanic in there. It just seemed like I spent way too much time countering every little thing from every volley, with my save on this particular portion of my ship. Let's roll to see if it actually did damage now that he's hit it.
So I
thought maybe that could all be combined into, like, the attack roll, rather than have to do opposed.
That's kind of the way they did it. So, like, you have... in each hit location, you had one hit point. And if someone hit you, then you would roll a save, which you had like a 50% save chance.
Right.
And they could have done instead just say every hit does some damage and that hit location has 10 hit points or whatever.
Right.
And you just keep taking it until it goes down, instead of every time there being a small chance of it going down.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's one other thing to track, and I think they did that just to make it so that you just put a damage counter there or you don't, and it's just, instead of counting up how much damage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, know. I understand why they did it, and so I look at it and say, yeah, it is sort of, you know, it's a simple system, and you have the 1d6, you're only
yeah, everything
1d6
was all
at
d6.
Any time.
Yeah, every roll was only 1d6.
Yeah, every roll was 1d6, and everyone had one hit point on each piece, but then in order to make it not an incredible bloodbath where you fire once and everything dies, and that you had all those saves, just made it yep. feel like, you know, when you've got 9 ships on a side, and the 9 ships are shooting at 9 different targets, they go, okay, this one shoots, roll, yep. what's the hit location here, roll, save.
Yep.
And then sometimes your hit locations had different sorts of effects, and sometimes those were a roll, and sometimes they weren't.
Yep, that's true.
And so every once in a while, I'd get hit in a location where I had to roll one more thing about it, and I thought, you know, this should be taken care of in one roll. You should do it, or, you know... Anyway, I wasn't incredibly fond of it, but it went fast, and it wasn't hard to learn or anything. Yep. I personally would have done it slightly differently.
Well, when we recreate this game with Pirates of the Spanish Main ships, we'll add much more complexity to it.
I do have those dozens of the Pirates of the Spanish Main ships, and we could go ahead and play this on there. That'd be awesome. Just use the same stats.
I think the rules are online, and I think we could mock it up. Yeah, I think I've seen pictures online of people doing that.
Because I know for a fact that Games Workshop and some of their games, they just give away the rules on their website. I'd look and see if this is one that they did.
Yeah.
They give away some. I know the Battlefleet Gothic, they give it away because they're hoping that you will buy the miniatures with the ship stats included with the miniatures.
That's their whole business model for that. But this one, because they're not selling the miniatures anymore, I think they may just say, oh, you know, who cares?
Who cares? Let's not publish it. Or I don't know. Or maybe they'll say, who cares? Let's let them have it.
Well,
so we'll check it out. We'll see if it's there and available. And if it is, we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Sure, that's right. Okay, so that was the last game of the night, and that was like a 6-hour game, by the way.
That was an incredibly long game. That was war game level.
I'm not complaining. It was fun. Oh, I enjoyed it, but it was 6 hours. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the next day, Sunday. So I played another of Daniel George's homebrew games, and this one was called Air Knights. This is a World War I air combat game with various airplanes flying around and trying to shoot each other down, biplanes and triplanes and things like that. He had come up with a system where you pick which maneuver you want to do from a card, and then based on your speed and the stability of your aircraft, you make a roll to see if you keep control of the plane. And if you don't, you'll start heading towards the ground and lose some altitude, and you can try to pull out. It was fun. It also went very fast, and it did have altitude, like I said, and you move your planes around on the map and have a 12-sided die next to each little plane counter to show what altitude you had. You could gain speed as you dive, lose speed as you climb, you could tail people if you're behind them. All these things you expect out of any good World War I airplane combat game. And in this scenario, I was a larger British bomber with 2 escort fighters, and we were supposed to bomb a German hangar next to an airfield. So I had the came in low and fast, bombed my 2 targets, my escorts engaged 3 German planes, and then hit my targets, and then just got blown to bits by the Germans, who finally said, hey, wait, that guy's bombing us.
Yeah.
So
are we to defend ourselves? We aren't.
So, but that was fun. I liked that game, too, and it also went really fast, and there was some similarities to his to Age of Sail and some of the roles and things like that.
Well, speaking of fun World War I flying games, we both also had a chance to try out, and I think you eventually bought, Wings of War.
Yes, that's right.
Which is a game of World War I air combat for 2 to 4 players.
Yes, he reads it right off the box.
Right there, it's on the box.
That I have here with me. Yes, I did get the basic set of Wings of War, which is called Famous Aces. And, yeah, this is fun. We played a demo of this, and I ended up buying it. And it's another super, I won't say really fast, but it is a very fast playing one-on-one. This has up 4 planes in it, so you could do up to 2-on-2.
Right.
Biplane dogfighting game, and it was a lot of fun. You put your plane down, you put down 3 maneuver cards. So, again, simultaneous action
selection. That's how we know what you're going to buy.
That's how we roll.
Or in fact, that's how you not roll, but how you plan out 3 phases in advance.
That's right. When you put down three, you flip them over, you do your maneuver, you flip another one over, you do your maneuver, and at the end of each maneuver, you just see if you're in range and try to shoot someone.
Yeah, and you try to shoot them, and if you're behind them, tailing allows you to see what their next card is, and you can rearrange your simultaneously selected actions if you'd like.
Yep.
And on top of the really good and easy playing and fun game that it is, and you can play it all with the basic set, and it's card-based and everything, they also sell miniatures for it. So if you really like to extrude it into the third dimension and have, you know, little ships with different altitudes flying around, or ships, little airplanes flying at different altitudes around, you can go ahead and spend that extra money and have a much more visually interesting experience.
Oh, yeah, and the miniatures look really nice. They're about, 3 inches long, I think. Something like that. Nice little biplanes.
They're great. They look really good. They look better than anything that came out of the Clicks people.
Yeah, and they're $12 to $15 each, which, depending on what your level is, that may or may not be expensive, but I think that's not too bad, and that's cheap enough that I was seriously considering picking up like 4 of them so I could do some 2-on-2 plane combat.
Right.
I may still do that.
It may be something you'll just have to, you know, meet out over the quarter. You know, just
that's
get
right.
one every 6 weeks.
Every quarter
or something.
I'll get one.
There you go.
But yeah, it's great, and the cards look great. It's really nice, and you just play on any old tabletop. You just pick a tabletop, you start it on the edge of the table, and just start flying towards each other, and try to, when you get close enough, try to guess what the other guy's going to do. And
that's
it's cool.
Right. It's a lot of fun. It was really good. Now, I didn't get a chance to play Air Knights with you, but I did get a chance to play the Wings of War.
Yeah.
And that was well worth it. Well worth the time doing.
Yeah, because
if you like World War One combat, things like Blue Max or...
Yeah, that's right. We played the demo, and then I went and bought it later. And then while we were sitting around waiting for another game, you and me and my cousin Michael... we're like, hey, let's play this. And we played through like 3 games in about 15 minutes. Once you get going, it's really fast. And it was fun.
It was.
I enjoyed it. And I will enjoy it in the future.
Yes.
All right. Moving on. I don't know why I was so excited about that. After...
Because it's a good game.
It's a great game, that's why. After Air Knights, I had my second game of Gutshot. So this one went much better. This was Sunday. I think it was at 2 p.m. on Sunday. The room was a lot quieter because it was Sunday. There's a lot fewer people there. And I had a position in the back corner of the big miniatures room instead of being, like, right in the middle. Mm-hmm. There was only about 7 people in this game instead of 10. And everyone really got into it and really played up the Old West characters that they got dealt. And
nice.
I had a great time running it.
Sounds like the 3 missing people were the ones that couldn't get into the game last time.
Maybe so. I don't know. I mean, it was an entirely different group. But but it was fun. Yeah, we had a good time. The school marm was there. She had her shotgun, and it was great.
That's awesome. School marm with a shotgun. You can't go wrong with that combination.
So, anyway, like I said, I'll get more into this game in a future podcast.
Right.
So, after I got all my stuff cleaned up and put away, I went to my last game of the night, which was Legends of the Old West.
Wait, are you telling me there's another Wild West game you played?
Apparently, they keep coming. I can't... I'm drawn
there's
to
just
it.
More and more, and you
I
just
can't stop.
You can't stop.
That's right. This is going to be the Old West Gaming Podcast before too long.
You know, I'm starting to wonder. That's all I'm saying. I'm just starting to wonder. You know, if they tell you write about what you know or podcast about what you know, soon enough
that's
we'll
right.
only
by
be
the way,
doing
you're coming to my game of Boot Hill next
of
week,
course.
Right? Okay. Make your character.
Okay.
So the last game of the night was Legends of the Old West. And I played this game last year. I really liked it. This was a different guy running it this year, but he had a really great-looking town with all these nice resin buildings and lots of painted miniatures. You were playing in that game, and wasn't that a great town that he
that
had sitting there?
That was a great town. Those, you know, that I want to say that terrain looked great, and so many people would walk by and see it and ask if they could take a picture of it. It was kind of disturbing because we're trying to move our guys and fire and roll and stuff, and people are like, "Ooh, can you move? I want to get a shot down the main street here."
Yeah, it was great. So there's some good pictures up on the website.
And all the buildings actually had like second floors in them, so you remove the roof and there was a second floor, and you could put people up on.
And
the
And you could remove
great.
The second floor and get down to
and
the
get
first
down
floor.
To the first floor.
Yeah, it was a very nice town. And he even made—I don't know if he told you this because he was chatting with me during your turn—but a bunch of them, the little signs that were on the buildings were actually magnetically attached so that he could swap them out for other signs that
oh,
he had made.
Nice.
And have, you know, changed it to a different town.
Oh, just like a Hollywood backlot.
That's right. Just like it. There's a little airbag that pops up. Guy can fall off the roof.
All right.
So anyway, Legends of the Old West, we had 6 players in this game. There was a 3-on-3 battle. You were on the other side.
Yep.
Each player had a posse of 5
makes our friendship stronger if I'm firing at you.
That's right. I don't know if I actually fired at any of your characters.
No, you didn't, actually.
You ended up being way on the back of the board, and I never reached you.
Yeah. I prefer to think of it as the front of the board, and you were skulking around the back of the board.
That's another way to think of it. So in this game, each player controls multiple characters. We had a posse, each had a posse of 5 characters, and I think we each had one guy who was like the boss, who was pretty good,
yes.
One guy who was the second in command, who was pretty good, less good, and then 3 guys who were like just thugs who would die on the first shot.
Right.
And every
character
had that.
Can we say not good at all? I don't know. I guess maybe they were
they had dreams and aspirations.
And dreams and aspirations.
So I really like this game. It moves quickly. The rules are simple. Everything's 1d6 again. The character statistics are simple. You know, the way it works, when you're trying to shoot at someone, you roll 1d6. You see if there's anything in between you. If it's a hit, then you see if there's anything in between you. If it hits any of the cover that you're hiding behind. If it gets through all that, then there's a roll on this grit table to see if you look at the character's grit attribute and you make a roll and see if they actually took damage. Every character pretty much has 1 hit point, except for the one tough guy on our team who had 2 hit points, or wound levels, they call it.
Right.
And because every damage has a grit save, it's like having multiple hit points. So your guy could be getting hit and hit, but as long as you keep rolling that, it's like you need to save, you take no damage. It's kind of like Man of War in that way.
Right.
They instead of everyone having multiple hit points, everyone has 1 hit point and then lots of saves every
lots
time you take damage.
Save, right.
So this is just a different way of simplifying things.
And I just for the record,
yes.
I found that to be wonky too. Just so you know. So it's the same mechanic,
okay,
more
well,
or less,
good.
But I found it to be just
you're
as wonky.
Consistent. You get a point for consistency then?
Yeah.
I'm marking that down right now.
But I only get 1, but I get multiple saves against consistency.
That's
all
right.
The time.
Yeah, and then they also did the same thing for ammo. There was no need to keep track of ammo because what you do is every time you fire your gun, you're rolling that 1d6 to hit. And if you roll a 1, 1 is always means you ran out of ammo and you have to reload next turn. I think that's the way it works.
Right.
When you're firing a 6 gun or something. And so you just keep firing and firing and eventually, oh, out of ammo.
Actually, what happened is when you fired and you got the 1, you had to re-roll for a jam or a reload.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
If it was a jam, it was the same effect. But there was a chance that if you did roll the jam, then there was another roll to see if it actually damaged you.
That's right.
Because that happened to one of the guys on my side.
Oh,
not
his gun
on my
blew
set
up
of
in
bosses.
His hand.
Well, he jammed and then... It wasn't a jam, it was a misfire, and then he did the roll to see if it damaged himself, and he didn't damage himself. He made that last save. So he got away not being damaged, but I remember that mechanic going down in there and having that be the problem.
I like having in these Old West games the fact that the firearms were so unreliable that they do have a chance to blow up in your hand every time you shoot them.
Yes.
And the ammunition is so unreliable that you get a lot of misfires and things like that. So
right.
it's always a...
Verisimilitude is good.
Verisimilitude, yes. It's a nice dramatic moment when that happens.
Yes, it is. I just have to say that when we were playing this game, the guy said when we first went up to the game, he said, "So, who here has played Legends of the Old West before?" And you raised your hand, and there were 6 of us, right?
Yeah.
And of the 6 of us, I think 4 or maybe 5 raised their hands, but I didn't because I had never played.
Uh-huh.
And he looks around and goes, "Okay, great, let's play." And I was like, "Wait a second. I don't know how to play." And
well, you did very well for not knowing how to play.
Well, and this was the funny bit, is that because I knew every roll was
1d6, right.
And everyone knew how to play, and a lot of people had internalized the table that
right.
you consult,
yeah.
and they had it memorized,
yeah.
so that they would say, okay, are you going
to
shoot? And I'm like, shoot. And they're like, roll it, and I'd roll 1d6, and then if everybody on my team went, yeah, then I knew that I got it, and if everyone on their team went, yeah, I knew that I missed.
And
so
you just
it was
knew
kind
you were trying to roll
way.
High? And roll
yeah.
6s and not roll 1s. And
yeah, I honestly wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to roll at any given time or what I was rolling against. They're like, okay, roll your grit. And I'm like, okay, I roll the 1d6. And they knew what, and like the games master knew what the stats were on my characters.
Yep.
And he would go, oh, you save. And I'd be like, great, thanks. And I didn't even know what number on my little character sheet I was rolling against. Had no idea. But I managed to play, and I didn't do too bad.
You did.
So,
you did well.
So if you're surrounded by people that know how to play the game and are willing to interpret all the die rolls, you can do pretty well.
You just, you know, you just, you knew what the ranges of your weapons were.
I did.
You knew what the ranges of the enemy's weapons were, and you knew how far your guys moved, so.
That's right. And I knew everything was a 1d6, so I was
play the ranges, and that's all you need to know.
That's right.
Trying to roll. And you had one of your...
Of course, everyone could have really screwed with me if for some reason they figured out that I wasn't going, that I didn't know what the roll was.
Yep.
I was just going by the fact that people on my team would cheer when I got it, and people on your team would cheer if I missed.
They could have been playing with you. Well, luckily you had some people on your side.
Yes.
Oh, and one of the neat things that he did, then he said that this was his own invention in the game, was he made these little laminated cards that he handed out ahead of the game. Each person got two cards. And what these cards had on them was each one had a quote from some Western movie. And so, and then it also had a game effect. And so at any time, you can pull one of these cards out and say, wait a second, and read your little Western quote in your best Western movie voice.
Right. So they had like badges. We don't need no stinking badges from Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
That's right. And when you say that and do it in a good voice, then you get, your guy gets an extra roll to hit when he missed or something like
that. Right. Or whatever it was that was on the card.
That's right. So we had
effects.
Various different effects. And I thought that was a fun thing, and people really got into the voices. And you got the MVP on the best performance.
I did. I'm going to toot my own horn here. Since I didn't have anything else going for me, like ability to know the game or the fact that I was, you know, that I wasn't winning or doing really well with a number of kills or shots or anything, when I did get to use my card, I did my very best John Wayne. And it was, in fact, a John Wayne movie, so I did my very best, you know, powerful, you know, sort of John Wayne, and everyone was like, wow, that was great. And then the funny bit is that I slapped the card on the table and I did the line and everything, and everyone was like, wow, that was great. And they looked and I go, oh, you can't play that card. And I'm like, dang, I did that whole thing. So then the next time when I actually did use the card, I'm like, okay, I'll try it again. And they're like, yeah, you gotta do the same way you did last time or you're not gonna get credit for it. I'm like, man, can't you just remember the last one and I'll just play it? But it was good. I got some prize money out of that, or prize Kubla bucks,
let's say. Some Kubla bucks. So that was fun. So I think I want to put that in my next year's Gutshot game if I run this again next year.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'll make some little cards. I'll get some quotes. I'll come up with some events in Gutshot that you could use that on. Like, you know, get your free shot on someone without a retaliation or something like that.
Right. And you only get, like, one or two.
We had two. Each player had two each. And you could only use it one time.
Right. So it was expended one.
And so you wait for the right dramatic moment to use it, or the right tactical moment, and then you say your cool line. And
the best part about the line is not just the tactical or whatever you get for the bonus, because that's, you know, give or take, whatever. That's not going to change a battle. But the best part about it is it adds to flavor. That's the thing. Is it brings you back into the, oh, this is a Western game, not you know, range out your guns, move 3 inches, you know.
Brings you back into the game, and people remember when they watched that movie and that line and the circumstances surrounding it and everything. And every time someone brought out one of those cards, like, someone would be like, oh, wait a minute, and they hold the card up, and everyone's like, ooh.
And I was like, ooh, okay, what are you going to do? And then the person would do their very best Western-y voice and slam it down on the table.
And I remember you had the card that its only purpose was to cancel someone else's card.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And so someone else brought out their card, no, and did their cool thing, and then you're like, oh, wait a minute, let me do this. Oh, I cancel your card.
Down and canceled. That was good. I used that one a little too soon. I should have waited. But yeah, it was fun while it lasted.
So
speaking of this game system, there was another game that I tried to get into, but I was, you know, out of the 8 players allowed, I was the 9th one to sign up, and nobody dropped out. So I sat and watched it for an hour, sort of longingly wishing that I were playing it. Somebody took the Legends of the Old West system and made a pulp game out of it, where they had, you know, Indiana Jones and The Shadow and Doc Savage and
Alan
Quartermain and a lot of these pulp heroes. And each one of the Legends of the Old West, or each one of the heroes, was one of these pulp heroes, and they were going to go get the treasure at the Temple of the Monkey God. And it was
this big, huge terrain
that was really fun, and the guy had put it together, used some bonsai trees from PetSmart to make it look all jungly.
Wasn't it the same guy who did the Legends of the Old West game?
No, the guy
that
did...
It was a different guy,
but the guy who ran the Legends of the Old West game that we played was a player in this game.
Oh, okay.
And he, as a matter of fact, he controlled a group of people. He was one of the only ones that wasn't a single hero. He controlled a group of 6, the Royal Archaeological Society of London or something.
Ah, cool.
And so he had, you know, native bearers and riflemen, and then his main great white hunter guy at the front or whatever.
cool.
Yeah, it was really fun. And these guys were moving around, and the Games Master controlled all the natives and controlled monsters and other sorts of things. It was great. It was very pulp, and the system lent itself really well to this because...
Yeah, you can tell it would be almost the same stuff. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it's essentially all the same stuff, and it was really good. And it was kind of fun to watch because they still had the... the simple mechanic, and then people saving against their grit to push through the pain or whatever.
Yep.
And it just shows you that when you have sort of a nice simple system like that sort of replicates cinematic adventure, whether it be in the Wild West or in the jungles of South America or wherever it was, then you can still have a good time and put together a good game. And he had a really great terrain too, and that never hurts.
Oh yeah, I think I have a picture of that in my Flickr feed. Is that the one with the little Angkor Wat type temple in there?
Actually, that one was the game of the Anglo-Burmese War.
That was the third Anglo-Burmese War.
Anglo-Burmese War.
I remember because his description said something like, "Hey, have you ever heard of the third Anglo-Burmese War? Don't worry, no one else has either. Come play my game."
Yeah, this one had a whole bunch of the bonsai trees to be a jungle, and it had a bunch of huts to be where the natives live, and it had an Aztec temple, ziggurat temple.
I think I have a picture of that in there too, but okay. It's a different spot in my Flickr set, but yeah.
Right, so that's what he has there. So it didn't have the Angkor Wat thing on it, but it did have... It did have a village and a nifty Aztec-looking pyramid.
Yeah, that was cool. Oh, the other neat thing about this was you had also one of your attributes was pluck.
Oh.
And every time you got hit and did not take damage, so you made your grit save, your character had to make a pluck save.
Right.
And this was to see if you cowered and ran for cover or not.
Right, right.
And that was one of the guy's special ability was he played his card. And it forced everyone within 6 inches to make a pluck save.
Yeah, and there were people that ran off the board or that ran... Well, failed that one and ran away. I was within 6 inches of him, and I had to run away from him.
And I think his quote was from Blazing Saddles. It was, "Excuse me while I whip this out."
Right, that was... That was
everyone within 6 inches.
That's a classic Western film, Blazing Saddles.
It's a
paragon of the genre.
And so everyone made a pluck save within 6 inches when they heard that. So that was fun. So Legends of the Old West. That's one that I went to look for the rule book for that because I was like, hey, that's kind of fun. I could play this with my cardstock miniatures. And it is out of print and no one has it anymore.
Out of print and no one has it anymore.
Yeah, I found
having such a huge presence at this year's KublaCon because there were like 3 or 4 different Legends of the Old West system-based game sessions going on.
You'd think it was
still in active production.
Yeah, it's out of print, and that the guy who ran Man of War and some of these Legends of the Old West people, they were all bellyaching about Games Workshop letting things go out of print too soon. Apparently, this is a pattern with them. Anyway, so I'm going to look for that rule book. I'm sure it's about out there somewhere. I might pick that up. That would be fun.
eBay is your friend, my friend.
It is. And hey, a shout out to Bay, one of our listeners in the Bay Area here,
Awesome listener.
That's right. Who showed up at KublaCon and played in my Gutshot game. So thanks for coming out, Bay, and it was good to see you again.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with him. Rock on, Bay.
Okay, so then on Monday morning, we played one of our last games of the convention, which was D&D Miniatures.
Yeah, it was D&D 4th Edition Miniatures game. So it was a preview of the new 4th Edition system using the D&D Miniature system. And it was a demo.
That's right. Neither of us had ever played this before.
Right, but apparently it's a very it's a very popular line. I mean, people buy the D&D miniatures,
and people seem to love it.
Yeah, people seem to love it, and I guess it's an excuse for people to buy pre-painted miniatures of their favorite races and classes.
Oh yeah, no, it's cool. There was in the dealer's room. There was someone selling, dozens, hundreds of them in a big bin there for a dollar each. It was great.
I know. I went through there saying, "Oh, I'd love to have this one. I'd love to have that one." And then I thought, "What am I going to do with these right now?"
And line them up on top of your computer monitor.
I will, or I have to get back into D&D and start doing that just so I could use the cool little characters.
They are really cool, though.
Yeah, so apparently the system that they were teaching us was very similar to what the 4th edition combat system will be for, you know, the role-playing game.
Right.
So essentially you have a couple of different stats. You have hit points, you know, an initiative bonus, your AC and save versus fortitude, reflex, and will, and then your basic attacks and special attacks, and that's it. And your movement and how far you can move.
Yeah, very simple.
Very simple.
Very simple, very fast.
Yeah, it was sort of like a glorified pretty chess in a way. I mean,
that was the way the guy was describing it.
Yeah. There weren't all sorts of very difficult, terrain and who acts what and first. It was nice, simple. You know, initiative. I do my attack. I do my save. Boom. You take damage. I don't take damage. I now can't move. So it was pretty cool. It was kind of fun.
And having the really cool little miniatures, I got to say, really adds to the game.
It really does.
If I was playing with counters on a board, it would be not nearly as fun as it was.
Right. If it were little cardboard counters, I would have passed it over. It was.
But having the actual big, you know, 4-inch tall green dragon that I was moving around the board was pretty cool.
A giant acid spewing dragon that was like 4 squares large and. Yeah.
And you had the dwarf and the ranger and the warlock and
yes,
yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was well worth doing and
I don't know if I want to actually buy any and play it now, but I don't actually want to buy them
to play. Although it's sort of a nice bonus, it's like buy a really cool pre-painted miniature, get a game for free. You know, it's not something you go look for your first thing. You don't say, oh, that game had such great replay value. It was so fun.
You know, maybe it does, and it is one of those collectible games, collectible miniatures. So maybe,
right.
You know, we were playing one of the basic sets. We were playing the starter set. So you know, it was fun, but I'm sure there's maybe a bunch more interesting things out there.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's cooler when you have 100 guys on your side instead of 3.
Right. Well, it seemed to me as we were playing that every individual character was an individual character. They all had their specific powers that they could do, their specific skill, their whatever. So it would be really hard to keep track of a large number of them.
It really would.
Because you'd have, well, which guy has the acid blast? Hold on. Yeah. Now that's the 4th elven sorcerer over here. So that wasn't as interesting. Now, the good part about what it is that if you get good at it and collect tons of them, and if you've got to buy them all and collect them all, you'll be all set for buying 4th edition D&D when it comes out. You'll already have the combat system down, which, from what I understand, having listened to some podcasts and seen some stuff around the web, they're sort of gutting the all of the tedious world building and personality building parts of a role playing game and just focusing in on what it is that people want to actually do when they play D&D, and that is throw magic missiles, backstab, and kill dragons. So that should be all right.
So I can't roll on the random insanity table anymore.
You know, as far as I know, there are no random insanities or underground dungeon type 2 encounters.
What about treasure type H? Is that at least in there? You gotta tell me. It's there.
If only I could say that it were.
Oh.
I don't know. So, again, I'm not following that as closely as I could. I'm sure there are going to be some people to correct me as I'm doing that. But from what I have heard in the number of podcasts that I listen to and the things that I've read on the web, and everything on the web is right. Right? Because it's been published. It's on the internet.
Someone wrote it. It's got to be right.
It's got to be correct if it's on the internet.
Just like everything we say is correct.
Absolutely. not a guarantee.
That's right.
Anyway, so yeah, we played that in the morning, and it was worth doing. It was especially worth handling the really cool pre-painted miniatures.
that was actually
more fun than the actual moving around and killing
part. That was the best part. Yeah. So anyway, after we played that, we went to my last game of the convention. I went to my last game of the convention, which was my wife Jocelyn's Monday afternoon game of Carcassonne. And again, another good group of players. Everyone had a good time. I'll mention, because I didn't mention it before.
I had as good a time as I normally have playing Carcassonne. I played in that game.
That's right. You were in that game.
I was in that game.
And thank you for couching it in such neutral terms.
I was glad to support your wife and her entrance into the con scene and her
use of Carcassonne.
I'm totally supporting her and what she's doing.
She goes again.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to make it a successful, fun time, so I was there, and I had the happy face, like, I love this game. And in fact, I'm just I'm just sort of over it. But,
yeah. Okay, well, anyway, thanks for coming anyway. Yeah. I'll say that we used the third edition farmer scoring rules in this, which were something I just sort of learned for this convention. They're a little different than we used to, but they're I think they're so much easier to score at the end of the game because you can just remove each piece off the board as you score it.
Having done it both ways now, I had not done it this way until this game. I'd only done it the old way.
Right.
And the old way really sucked and was really confusing for scoring. And this way was so much easier. I thought, yeah. I don't care if the scores are slightly different.
Yeah.
This is
well, as long as you know how it's scored while you're playing, it's no big deal. It's great because at the end you just point to each piece.
And there was a little bit of an arm wrestle over that at the very beginning with people. Because there were some people insisting that they wanted to do it the original way.
Well, they didn't even know that there were different ways.
They didn't
ways.
Know that there this were different
the
ways.
A lot of people don't even know there.
And you had to produce the documentation and say, this is the way we're doing it.
We're doing third edition.
Modify your strategy accordingly.
That's right. And I think that woman who was complaining, she still won anyway, so...
She did, so I don't see what her big problem was.
Anyway, so we have five players in that game. Five, right? Or was it six? No, it was five. It was you, me, Jocelyn, and...
There were
that
six.
Woman and that British guy.
Well, okay, so the British guy's girlfriend was sitting next to him, and that's what I'm seeing in my head.
So there's five players. So, again, playing with five players, totally different from playing with two.
Absolutely.
One of the variants we did in this game was, in order to speed things up a little bit, we used the rule that after you play a tile, you immediately draw another tile and keep it secret in your hand so that you can be looking at it as the turn moves around the whole rest of the board.
Right.
And then... The intention is that you're looking for your next move the whole time. But, you know, the downfall of that is that you really have to have a plan B, C, and D as you do that.
Exactly.
Because all these other people may possibly take the spot that you had your eye on.
Which not happened to me a lot.
Yeah, not to mention that when they place a tile, maybe there's suddenly a whole new great spot for you to place that appears. So.
But it takes a little bit of the analysis time away and allows you to front load it a little bit to you so you're not drawing it, looking at it for the first time and saying, wow, now what is this tile? And asking people, you know, like, oh, where could this go?
That's right. It gives you more time to think, and which is always good.
Yeah.
So that's everything that I played at KublaCon. So, Nate, you were in a lot of those games, but you also played some that I did not play. So let's hear about those.
I did. Well, I don't want to bore our listeners. You're not bored. You want to hear this.
They're an hour into this already.
That's
so.
Right. This is why they haven't skipped already and gone to the end. There are two that I want to talk about that I did. There were other ones that I wanted to do but either didn't get into or canceled out of in favor of some other game.
Right.
Or some that I had planned on doing but then were canceled because the person had walked away.
And I have one of those that I want to talk about too, but I'll talk about that at the end.
Okay.
Something I wanted to play but it was canceled, so go ahead.
Yeah, all right. So rather than talk about all those, I'll just talk about the two that I went to that weren't that you weren't there for. That was the first one was Simplified Great Battles of History.
All right.
Now, I had not heard about this other than the fact that I saw, ooh, Great Battles of History. I love that. I like battles. I like history. I like great things. I'm going to go do that. And
you
it said
like
Simplified.
Preposition of?
I love the preposition of is one of my favorite prepositions, right after in spite of. Anyway, so I looked at this and I thought, it has the word simplified in it, and it's a war game. I love the idea of a simplified war game, so let me go play it.
How complicated can it be?
Well, as a matter of fact, let me tell you how complicated it can be. Now, simplified always means, in this context I found out, doesn't mean it's not an exact amount, like, oh, it's simple, therefore it's simplified. It means it's simpler. It's a relative rather than an absolute.
That's right.
So apparently it's more simplified than the original Great Battles of History series. According to Board Game Geeks, it says it's a significant simplification. I would not call this significantly simple in an absolute sense.
Yeah.
However, it was right at sort of the mark of what I like to play.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it was too complicated for me. It wasn't. It was just fine. But I looked at this and thought, if this is simplified, I certainly do not want to see what the other one was.
I know.
The people that I was playing with all played Great Battles of History, though. And so they were playing this like a checkers game, saying, well, you know, if this were really Great Battles of History, we'd have this and that and the other. And, you know, we'd have all these sorts of things that that make this look like checkers instead of chess. And I was like, oh, you're kidding me. It can be more complicated than this.
It's kind of like Federation Commander, which is supposedly vastly simplified from Starfleet Battles, but it's still very complex.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I look at Federation Commander, which we're going to talk about in another podcast.
Yes.
But I look at that and go, wow, this is a fully crunchy, complicated game, and this is the simplified version of Starfleet Battles.
Same thing for like Car Wars 5th Edition, although that is it's much simpler than Federation Commander, but still, you know, has its own complexities.
Has its own set of complexities. So,
as compared to the original Car Wars.
Yeah, so I played the Alexander Phalanx Wars, so it was you know, the Alexander series, and I think we were stomping the Greeks. It was the Macedonian army, and we were stomping the Greeks.
And this was an actual historical battle.
Yeah, these are all actual historical battles, and they have the number of you know, chariots or, you know, spearmen, pikemen units or whatever they are.
And there's an expected result for this battle also.
There is. That was the other thing that I thought was really interesting. Now, I'm used to playing all sorts of science fiction and fantasy war games. Those are my preferred sort of genre of war games.
That's right.
But I have nothing against historical war games. I love... I went for this. So of course, I was interested in doing it. But these particular games, the Great Battles of History series, pretty much assumes that it's going to end up how history says it was going to end up.
Right.
And from talking to the people and from playing the game, they're like, this is the battle where Alexander walks all over the Greeks and beats them. And I go, well, so are the Greeks, you know, the Greeks have a fighting chance. They're like, well, no. I mean, you know, it's how long can you put them off? How many, you know, how many casualties can you inflict? You know, if you get really lucky and the other person is really dumb, or, you know, or they don't play well or whatever, you can turn it around and maybe have the Greeks come out on top. But these people who I was playing with said, literally, we've never seen the Greeks win this scenario. This is, and in talking to them about this series, that's generally how a lot of this series goes.
Oh,
they want to play out a specific historical battle, and they want the result to be had the historical result.
And it maybe go, you know, a few turns in either direction, maybe a little easier or harder than it was.
Yeah, it'll be a little easier,
at the
a little harder.
Battle, but if it comes out the wrong way, then they may look at those games and say, oh, this game is broken. It's not.
Right.
The
right.
scenario is didn't come out the way it was supposed to.
We have to change the mechanics of how we're playing this so that we make sure that this number of chariots and footmen beats that number of chariots and footmen. And
yeah,
so
because that's how it came out. And so.
Exactly. So you have to make sure it fits.
So it's you know, and
it's a different
nothing
mindset.
Against that, but it's a different mindset. That's right. You have to go into it knowing that you are going to win or going to lose.
Right.
And then it's a matter of how well do you play, as well as you can, to within those parameters.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's very different than science fiction or fantasy, where there is no historical precedent.
Right, right.
With the exception of, you know, television series that ended a certain way, and you know how the Great War in Babylon 5 is going to end up.
We know how the Battle of Helm's Deep went.
We know how the Battle of Helm's Deep went. So, I mean, you know, in spite of like that, there aren't a lot of games. A lot of those games don't try to make the game end exactly like
that.
Yeah,
that's right. And or they'll have ones where you don't, you know, you can pick your forces based on a point limit or something like that.
Exactly.
And they're supposedly sort of balanced. Or if one side's ahead, you know, you expect that they're going to win most of the time. But it's not an expected result every time.
Exactly, exactly. So this was a lot of fun. I mean, it was sort of your standard, you know, chit and hex grid board game. Every little chit had, you know, like 7 different numbers on it, and the different numbers meant different things, and some of them all meant the same thing but in different conditions, which I thought was interesting, because they're like, oh, okay, so the white number here that's on the gray background, that's the amount of movement they have, and I try to move them there, and they're like, oh, no, you can't use that one. You have to use the gray number on the black background for this movement in this turn or whatever. And I went, all right, well, then you should have told me that when you were telling me what the little chit said. And so there was lots of stuff like that. I've played a lot more games that I enjoy that are the war game sort of genre that I enjoyed more than this, but it was fine. It was good. It was a good experience
to have. Good to learn something new like that.
Oh yeah, and by new I mean like 40 years old.
That's right. All of the new things we learn are out of print 20-year-old games.
That's right. Well, I mean, the simplified Great Battles of History was published in 2000, supposedly.
Oh, okay.
But the Great Battles of History series, I think, goes much older than that. And if they don't go much older, their printing is much older, because these things, you know, reek of 1970s, you know,
box art and production values.
Exactly.
So that game on the schedule was scheduled to be 1 hour long. How did that go?
Yeah. Well, and this is what made me think it was going to actually be a simple game, because I looked at it, I'm like, simplify Great Battles of History, 1 hour, I'm in for it. And I had another thing that I wanted to do at the end of that 1 hour and thought, this will be great. So I showed up, and the guy himself didn't show up until 20 minutes into the game, you know, into the time. You know, he was late, he showed up 20 minutes into the hour, and I'm thinking, we're not going to play this game in an hour, are we? And then we spent 15 minutes, maybe, setting up the board, right, because every different unit had its position where it started and a certain hex number and facing, right, and all, right, that sort of stuff. So you had to put them exactly where they had to go.
Getting those all out of the carefully sorted counter trays and all that.
Exactly. Well, actually, this one was even worse. They were in little plastic baggies, so we had to pull them out of the plastic baggies, find the correct one, and say, oh, that's the Macedonian, you know, the Macedonian chariot. Oh, no, that's the Macedonian heavy chariot. We're not using that for this, you know, for this thing. So leave the heavy chariot off. I'm like, great, okay, so we're looking for the chariot. There's the chariot. Now where do we put it? We put it on hex 4983. And I'm looking at it, and where's hex 4983? I put it there. So we did that for a long time. And I figure this is part of the game.
Sure. Right?
This is part of the setup.
Sure.
Yeah, why not? I'm saying, oh, this is exciting to see. Well, I use exciting meaning not exciting. I was looking at it.
You're
going,
no, it's,
you know, it's all part of the setup, and it's,
sure,
part of the experience of playing the game. And so we only got like 25 minutes of actual play, in which we moved, I think, two turns.
Uh-huh.
I think we did two turns.
Two turns each?
Yeah, two turns, okay, each. So each side. Each side got to do, you know, two movement attack sorts of,
okay,
things. And then I had to excuse myself. I'm like, hey, I've got this other game that is, you know, I'm not to say yours isn't fun, but I've got this other game that I'm really looking forward to, and you started late. And they're like, well, why do you guys have to go? And we're like, well, it says an hour. And some of the other people I were playing with also were leaving. And the guy said, why do you do that? And he said, well, look, it says an hour. And he goes, oh, that was a mistake. We meant to put down 8 or something. And I'm like, oh, so this was supposed to be an 8-hour game or a 6-hour game or several, you know, 4-hour games. But
that's,
you put it in the computer as 1 hour. And
that's a major error.
It is, especially for a war game. But see, that led to the whole idea that I had that this was somehow, you know, objectively simple.
Sure,
you know, I was,
yeah,
like, oh, if I'm going to play, you know, this famous battle from, you know, Alexander's Conquest in an hour, it's going to be a simple game. And then I found
makes
out,
sense,
indeed, it isn't. So,
well, let's hope that next year they put the proper number of hours on it.
Yeah, I hope whoever he does, he actually fills in the little chart for number of hours rather than just leaving the default, which I think was 1. So
probably he just missed that field.
He
in
probably
the
missed
database.
The field, hit enter, and then it added it in. Yeah, yeah, I don't blame him for anything except inattention to detail. That's it. The other,
okay,
game that I played, and I really enjoy this, is Pizza Box Baseball.
Now, you're a huge baseball fan, isn't that right, Nate?
I hate baseball. No, at the risk of offending some people that are listening, I'm sorry. I really don't like baseball. I don't like watching baseball.
I know you're
not following baseball.
Not a big fan.
I even have sort of weird psychological issues from my childhood against baseball. And it's mostly because I played baseball as a child, and it made me grow to loathe the game.
Sort of
no offense
opposite
to my old coach if he happens to be listening.
Sort of the opposite effect from what they intended.
It did. They wanted it to build teamwork and have me have a lifetime love of baseball, and what it ended up doing is poisoning the well. So I was no longer able to enjoy baseball, and haven't for 30 years. So,
so why play a game called Pizza Box Baseball?
So why would I play Pizza Box Baseball? Okay, this maybe is verging on too much information, but I decided that I want to confront the things that I hate.
Hey, all right.
And overcome those,
well,
things.
Well, I love,
so,
that's a great motivation.
Right. So before Kublai Khan, but even before I knew that this game was being played, I rented the Ken Burns 10 DVD disc
wow,
History of Baseball, and I think I only managed to watch 6 of them before I just ran out of time. You
I say, even so, you're just
much.
Diving into the deep end there.
I did. I just said, I've got to know more about this. I have to understand my enemies. No, I just thought, you know, I want to get over this. It's the great American pastime. Everybody,
sure,
else seems to think it's worthwhile, and I just have nothing but bile for it. So I thought I'll just...
You want to at least bring your bile back up to the neutral level.
That's right. I want to just be neutral towards it. And so, you know, starting several months ago, I started watching all of those things. And then when I saw it come up on Kublai Khan, I went, great. I've heard good reviews. There are people who have reviewed it and said it was really good. People that reviewed Pizza Box Football, which was also created by the same people. They, you know, so they got good reviews for that. I said, well, it's probably a well-crafted game. I'll play the game. We'll see how it goes. And I've got some time, and it'll keep me from playing Carcassonne a second time. So I'll go. So it's designed by Scott and Eric Smith. And Eric Smith was, I believe it was Eric Smith, if I remember his name correctly, was the guy who actually demoed it for us.
Oh, great. So he was there at the con.
Yeah, the co-designer was there at the con, explained the game to us, did the demo, broke open a couple of brand new sets, and had the people play, had all of us there at the demo play. All right, so Pizza Box Baseball is a game played with two players, although you can put more people into it.
So, like, 18, right? 9 on each side?
No, yes. 18 players. You could do each one as their own bet. You'd be incredibly bored, and that would bring this game back to the level of boredom that I feel with baseball. So, no, you don't want to have 18 players, 9 for each side. You want two players, okay. One for each team to do that. Essentially, you take turns. You represent the team. You have a card that represent, or you have a pitcher, and he gets worse over time, and you get a certain number of kinds of pitches you draw from a deck, and you put out what sort of pitch you want. Now, the pitches are not curveball, slider, slower, whatever. They're more like, this is an aggressive pitch or a not aggressive pitch. They're actually called like a, I've now even forgotten what. There's one where you toss a strike or a ball, essentially.
Okay.
And so you have aggressive or passive. And then when you're a hitter, you have a certain number of cards in your hand that are, you know, I choose to aggressively go after the ball to hit it, or I want to, you know, pass and let it go by, or I want to check my swing or whatever and be passive about it. And then so simultaneously, you select... Oh, wait. Simultaneous action selection.
Hey, let me put this one on my list.
You should. Put on your list to buy.
Pizza Box Baseball.
But it's not multiple turns. It's just for that turn, though.
Okay.
And so you have that, and you simultaneously put down what sort of pitch you're doing and what sort of hit you're doing. And then from that, you compare those, and that tells you what result deck to draw from. And the result deck says, you know, whether your guy gets on base or whether it's a grounder, he goes to second.
Okay.
It also tells you, now as you go through, you keep track of which batter you are, if you're batter number one, batter number two, batter number three. And apparently in baseball, the strong batters are not the very first, but they're like the second, third, and fourth. So you get the first person who gets on base, second, third, fourth, continues to fill the bases, and then you have your, you know, guy that hits it really far in a home run.
All the big fans are laughing at us now discovering basic baseball strategy.
They are, discovering basic baseball strategy. Well, no, I'll tell you why. On my baseball team, I batted like eighth.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Which, if you're not playing...
Second cleanup, right? Yeah.
You know,
you're there,
like
getting the second round of batters all home.
Yeah, there you go. The second round after everyone's there. I guess that's what maybe they tried to tell me. But what essentially that means, that position means, is the person who can't hit worth spit, which was me, right? So I'm there at the end, and I had no idea why everyone else was going first. And it was because, well, they could hit the ball, and I couldn't, so I was farther on in there. So when they explained that to me, I went, oh, this explains a lot about the hitting order and where I was in the game.
Oh, okay.
So
makes sense.
So yeah, so there it was. So you compare, it gives you a result, and if you're a strong hitter, you get a better result. If you're a weak hitter, you maybe get a weak result.
And you have some strong and some weak hitters on the team, right?
Yeah,
do you have strong and weak hitters. Choose the order they go in?
No, there's the batting order.
Oh, it's predetermined.
The predetermined batting order. And then you keep track of how many outs there are. You essentially don't play every pitch, but you play every at bat.
Okay, sure.
So, you're
so
not
it's
doing,
a little more abstract. Though.
Right, it's slightly more abstract. You keep track of, you know, which guys are on base, and also which guys are on base determines when you draw your outcome cards. It will, maybe it says, well, if you have a guy in second, then he goes to third, but if you don't have anybody on second, then it's no result. You know, whatever the hit was, no result. And you essentially play through every inning. You play through every inning, you get three outs, you switch places, then the person gets their, you know, the person that was hitting now gets the pitching deck, and the person that was, and the other person switches up, and you go back and forth.
So you're sort of in the position of maybe the team manager or team coach, sort of calling the pitches or telling the batters when to steal and things like that.
Yeah, more or less. You're there.
This tells you how little I know about baseball.
I know. Well, you're in the position. You're simultaneously playing those. If you are the batter, you can decide that you're going to bunt or you're going to steal. And when you're steal, you're playing the one of the base coaches who says, "Go ahead, go steal," or maybe the player himself decides to go steal. And so you do that instead of swinging at a pitch, or just before you swing at the pitch and you do the pitch. So and then so the people that are pitching, it's you get to choose whether you're doing an aggressive pitch or a passive pitch, or whether or not you're trying to keep track of the people on base for a pitch out for someone trying to steal. And so in that way you're playing a combination of maybe the catcher who says what sort of pitch to do, or the coach saying make sure you do these sorts of pitches against this person. But it becomes
sort of more high level strategy then.
Yeah, it's a slightly more high level strategy, and it becomes one of the mechanics that you really like, and that is the, well, he thinks that I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do that, but he knows that I'm going to do that, so I'm going
to
fool
him.
Right.
Trying to guess what the other person's doing and trying to not let them guess what you're doing.
Right, right. And so there's a bit of that going on, and that was really interesting to try to do. You try to outthink the guy who's playing across from you, and you also are constrained by what's on the board. You look at the board and say, well, at this point, they really want to hit somebody home, so maybe they'll be more aggressive and they won't be as passive.
And then your pitcher is also slowly getting used up as the game goes on, right?
Yes, and then at a certain point, you can switch out for a different pitcher who has different stats depending on what. So you have your middle pitcher, your cleanup pitcher, your different relief pitchers who come in with different stats depending on what inning it is. And so at a certain point, you take your pitcher out and you put in a new pitcher who has a different set of stats.
Okay.
There's a certain amount of card counting you can do because there are proportions between how many passive and aggressive pitches there are.
Oh, okay.
And so you can guess as to the size of the person's hand what the proportion will be.
Oh,
and if they, oh, look, they put down 4 aggressive ones so far. Okay, well, they probably won't have any more aggressives. And so then and you can do that. So you can try to play that secondary mind game. We were just learning, so there were a lot of things we were not we were not doing.
Now, if I recall from reading about this, there's no actual teams or actual players mentioned at all in this, right? It's very abstract, right? Just like team one versus team two?
Absolutely. It's the red team versus the blue team.
Yeah.
Actually, it's visitor versus home is what it is. And so there are no actual baseball licensed properties at all involved with this.
Okay.
It's baseball in the abstract, or baseball as an American ideal.
I see.
As opposed to baseball as like I'm playing the Mariners against whoever.
So maybe if you're a big fan, you can project whatever your team you want onto this.
Well, as a matter of fact, the guy that I was playing against was a big baseball fan.
Of course,
really enjoyed it, and he spent his time doing the Bob Uecker commentary on it. He was in there, he's like, "Oh, we've got the number 2 guy. You get somebody on first, and he's going for the pitch."
Cool. Oh, that's
and he
good.
Was doing
he's
that,
into it.
And he would always, and he would say things like, "Oh, this is just like so and so." Let me just name. This continues to show you how much I don't follow and don't like baseball. It's like, I can't even think of somebody. Daryl Strawberry. It's just like when he did such and such a thing against such and such a team, and he'd look at me like, "Isn't that right?" And I'd be looking at him, and I'd just say, "Absolutely, friend. You hit the nail on the head. This is just like that."
Well, see,
not
that
knowing who he was talking about or what game he was talking
about. So that's
about.
Cool, because the big baseball fan is playing it and he's recognizing situations in the game that remind him of actual situations from actual baseball games.
Yes.
And meanwhile, you're playing it more on a high-level strategy abstract level and both having fun with it.
Absolutely.
So
we were both having fun. So we enjoyed it at different levels and for different reasons. And I remember remarking to myself, I said, this really in a sense feels like a baseball game in that the stuff that's happening, it's following the way baseball works
and
the way that each game sort of feels when you're watching it, but all on a compressed time scale.
Oh,
so
sure.
If you're sitting for hours and hours waiting between pitches, your at-bats, you can do 3 at-bats in literally a minute and a half or something.
It's just you play a card, they play a card,
you play a card, they play a card, you resolve. You play a card, they play a card, you resolve. You have a little bit of friendly banter, you play a card, they play a card, you resolve it. And now you've gone through an entire inning, boom, like that.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
And that takes out a certain amount of the current level of boredom that I feel with baseball. I really liked Pizza Box Baseball. I was really tempted to buy it, except that if I came home with it, my wife would say, "Who are you, and what have you done with my husband?" Because I'd be like, "My husband coming home with a baseball game? I can't. can't believe it. They brainwash you there at Kublai Khan or something.
Then you're going to start watching baseball on TV, and you'll be like, look, there, he's using an aggressive pitch card.
There you go. He's using an aggressive pitch card. Oh, he should really be using the pitch out card. Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I still don't know if I can do that.
I think that's unlikely.
Yeah, really, really unlikely. Although, if I do end up watching it, I will play it on 4-speed fast-forward to be the same length of time as the Pizza Box baseball
game. I've heard that's the way to watch baseball, is on the TiVo at quad-speed fast-forward.
It's got to be it. I don't know.
Well, that's cool. So I'm glad you found another game you liked.
It was. It was a good game, and I liked it. I had a good time playing it, and it's one that I would and will play again.
Cool. So that's all the games we played. Let me briefly talk about what I picked up in the dealer's room this year, because there's some stuff I was excited about.
Oh, yeah.
And you can mention anything that you got, too. I, of course, got another set of dice as I, another 7-die set of gamer dice that I really don't need, but I feel obliged to buy when I go to Kublai Khan.
You know, Chessex owns your soul.
They do.
I just thought I'd let you know. Chessex
so,
and you.
Got another nice set of dice there. And I think I also got another set of 6-sided dice because I was going to use those for gut shots. So I actually have a ton of dice.
And you also bought other little chips.
Yes, that's right.
From Chessex as well, because they have little unmarked chips.
Yeah, they had little colored chips.
Tiny discs.
Little tiny discs,
quarter inch across or
something like that, like a half inch across. And they were all in different colors. So I got some red, yellow, and green ones, which came in really handy for the gut shot game. They're just perfect to indicate different states of movement.
Right, whether they were running or trotting or whatever.
Oh, yeah, it was just what I was going to come up with my own little counters for those. I never got around to it, so yeah, it worked out great. The other thing I found in the dealer's room, there was a guy selling these little terrain pieces that he had made, and they're really, he had made them somehow really cheap. It looked like they're made out of compressed rock or resin or some kind of recycled thing, and they were just spray painted really roughly, but he was making little, like, resin, like, little walls and crates and things, and they came out, because those all just have to be one color, they came out looking really good, and they were really cheap. He was selling these little terrain pieces, like little crates and little bundles of wood and piles of lumber and things like that, and they were like four for a dollar.
Right. Which is dirt cheap for a sort of resin working terrain piece.
And these were like
just
the right scale for like 30mm miniatures, which is about what Gutshot is. So I bought a whole bunch of those, $3-4 worth.
You bought a pocketful.
That's right, bought a pocketful of those, and I used those in the game, and it came out great because I could throw a lot more cover on the board. People could hide behind crates and piles of lumber and stuff.
Yeah.
I bought Wings of War, which we mentioned earlier. I bought a copy of Puerto Rico, which I don't think much needs to be said about that, but my wife had heard about it and wanted to play it, so I was like, hey, all right. And we have since played it, and she likes it, so, all right. I bought the latest Battle Stations expansion, Pirates of Trundlia.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I know, we got to play Battle Stations again. It's been a while. And finally, my wife got, because another game that she bought that she thought would be fun to play is Bang. And she got the big...
This is yet another Western.
Yet another Western game. And I didn't even ask for this one. She just picked it up.
Well, because she sees your current obsession. She knows what you're doing.
Apparently she does.
Trying to feed the beast.
Well, she's feeding it well. So this was Bang, and it was not just Bang, but there's a big... kind of like the Carcassonne big box, they have a set that has Bang plus two or three of the expansions, and it's in a big bullet-shaped canister that's a foot tall. It's called the Bullet, so it's Bang the Bullet. And so I have this giant bullet sitting on the table at home. It's great.
Yeah,
I'm going to bring that into the next gut shot.
Yeah, I thought if anything else, the giant bullet that's the case.
It's very eye-catching. It's a big metal bullet. Anything that you got that you wanted to mention?
Oh, yeah. I want to pimp one of my favorite game companies these days, or rather, I don't want to call them my favorite. I do want to say that probably they're going to send their kids to college based on how much money I spend on their stuff, but it's Your Move Games.
Oh, right.
And you can go to www.yourmovegames.com. In the show notes, they do Battleground Fantasy Warfare.
That's right. We did an early show again about Battleground Fantasy Warfare.
Yeah, it was one of our beginning podcasts. We talked about them because we liked the game so much. And I like the game so much, I bought every army that they've come out with.
Cool.
And they were showing demos of future expansions that they were going to do, and their foray into non-fantasy historical warfare using the same system.
Right, so they had Romans and Carthaginians or something like that.
Yes, it was Roman Carthaginian.
And you could use just all the same system, yeah.
Exactly, and I pledged my further money to them on doing that. I said, well, you come out with it, I'll buy it. This is the name of the game. You produce a game, I buy it.
Kind of makes you wish you could just subscribe to it and just have it sent to you.
Really? No, I should call Chad and find it, or I'll send him an email and say, can I just, I'll just give you my credit card number, and when you come out with something new, send me a new one. I bought from them because they didn't have anything I didn't already own. They were just showing, you know, upcoming things that were coming out right. later this summer and in the fall, which, you know, to me was way too far away for my taste. I did buy from them a copy of Space Station Assault, which is one of their games.
Oh, right. I want to play that at some point.
Well, okay. I have it right in the other room. Maybe after the podcast.
maybe so.
I also bought... They also came out with a... For Battleground Fantasy Warfare, a bunch of terrain sets. So these are flat, you know, walls, lakes, bushes.
Oh, right. That you just sort of cut out and then you can place them on the board.
Exactly. And so they go well with the very flat card-based armies.
Oh, right, yeah.
Everything can fit in a flat area.
You could cut them all out and put them in a binder or something.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You folder. Could,
exactly. And so I bought a set of that, and I asked him about it, and he said, well, this is all the stock we have left, so if this is what you're going to buy. And I said, has this really sold well? And he said, yeah, people are buying this for all sorts of other games. They're doing it for DBA.
Oh, yeah. Any other war game that's
any other
that
sort
scale.
Of war game that's that scale they want to do. Well, people want to use the terrain for it, because it really is nice and easy, and it looks good. And so I bought a set of that.
Cool.
I bought Space Station Assault. I also bought two other games in the Hero Card System from
right.
TableStar Games.
I think we mentioned this in last year's KublaCon podcast, was I had played Hero Card Rise of the Shogun.
Yes.
And I also got Hero Card Heroes of New, Olympia,
New Olympia,
which
right.
was their superhero-based game, which is not a great game, but it's got more of the same system.
Yes, it's the same system, and it was superhero, so I was more than willing to play it with you. And I also played the Rise of the Shogun one with you.
Rise, which is a really good game.
I really liked Rise of the Shogun, so much better than
one.
Champions of New Olympia by like a long shot. It was really good.
But the cool thing about it is because the hero decks are all compatible, you can take the superheroes and bring them into Rise of the Shogun, and it's right. great. And now you have 8 different characters to play with instead of 4. It's great.
There you go. So you can have as many as you want. I bought 2 games from them, essentially sight unseen, meaning game unplayed. I bought them because I already knew the conflict mechanic. I already sort of liked the way they were. I read some reviews. One of them I bought Hero Card Orc Wars.
Oh, yes. I wanted to play that.
I know. That was why I have it. That and I wanted to play it. I really love orcs. I love orcs from just about every sort of game I could ever think of or get.
Cool.
I liked orcs, and so I thought, well, the idea.
How come you didn't have an orc team in Blood Bowl? Someone already picked that before you got your chance.
No, actually, the reason why I didn't
it's
have that is because we were buying miniatures.
Oh, yeah.
And the miniatures that were available, well, there weren't any Blood Bowl miniatures available, or not many, in our local gaming
right.
store. And this is pre-internet, so you can just order them from anywhere. So if the gaming store didn't have them, you
yep.
didn't have them. And so
right.
I played a mix of humans and elves, not because I liked the idea of humans and elves, but they had elves that were Blood
true.
Bowl, and the human ones were modded. I modded those from just regular fantasy miniatures.
Yes, that's what I had to do with my Chaos Human team in Blood Bowl. They were Chaos Human Warhammer Fantasy guys, and I went and clipped their swords off, and they were
exactly.
just a guy with his fist out and holding a pommel.
Right, and one of the other guys we played with had Skaven because the game store had Skaven.
That's
and
right.
that was it. You know, it's like so I could have gone to the great lengths of having the of getting orc figures for other
could have
from
mail,
other systems
mail ordered and, them or something
and mail ordered them and done all of that, but it was really easy to just buy the blister packs of the the elves, and
that's
I
true.
Already had, you know, human fantasy figures, and I just bought a couple more complimentary ones.
Okay.
So that's the reason why.
Okay.
If we were playing it again today, and if I had the money behind, you know, I was putting money behind it of being an adult with a job, I would be an orc team.
All right.
So,
good to know.
Just so you know, I really like orcs, and so the idea of Orc Wars with a conflict resolution system that I already know sounded really good. So
cool.
I thought, oh,
cool.
I,
yeah. Let's play that sometime.
I bought a second hero card system solely on the I don't want to say genre, but solely on the Chrome.
Okay.
I don't even ever expect to play this game. Although, maybe I'll talk to you sometime. It'll be fine. But it's Hero Card Nightmare, also the Hero Card system. And it's essentially all the players are lucid dreaming in the same nightmare, and you're trying to get the nightmare monsters to kill the other people and not you. And you're supposed to be the one that survives to wake up, right?
Cool.
So I liked the idea of having this surreal nightmare dreamscape where people are lucid dreaming, sending their Freddy Kruegers after each other. And whether or not it's a good game or plays well, I have no idea. I just really like the idea of playing a game about nightmares.
Cool.
So I bought it.
Hey, well, we'll give it a try. It sounds explained some of the rules to me, and it sounded interesting. So yeah, we'll give it a try.
Oh yeah, yeah. The other things that I didn't think I bought anything else. I won a bunch of games with my Kubla Bucks. If you win games, or however the games master or whoever's running the game defines win. You know, sometimes it's most valuable player, sometimes it's last man standing. However they define win. You can get a pin that shows you won a game, and they'll also give you Kubla Bucks, which are, I love saying it that lame too, Kubla Bucks, that you can redeem over at a prize counter. And so I picked up a bunch of games at the prize counter with my prize money.
Yeah, they get all the dealers and vendors to donate some stuff to the prize vault. And then as people win, you get these Kubla Bucks, and you can buy stuff out of the vault. Although, if you wait till the last day...
You get crap, because all there is crap left in the prize hall on the last day.
Well, that's also true, but I was going to say, if you wait till the last day, they're trying to get rid of everything, and you can get a lot more for your money.
Yes.
But it's a lot more crap for
your
money.
That's right. You can get five pieces of crap, because the Kubla Bucks are dollar for dollar what it is on the price tag.
Yeah, they pretty much match the MSRP on there.
Yeah, they match the MSRP. So you need 25 Kubla Bucks, which means you need to win like five games where you get like five Kubla Bucks.
Yeah, they usually give out 10 or 15 Kubla Bucks per game.
Okay, so yeah, sometimes they're split up, sometimes they give them all to the same person. So you need to win a number of games during the first bit of the con in order to get a premium nice game that you'd always wanted. If you wait until the second to the last day or the very last day, now they're starting to blow them out and they're wheeling and dealing and they're like, well, I'll give that game to you for 5 or 10 or whatever. But honestly, they're not.
They're not that great. I got a few games. I got Planet Busters, which is a Tom Wham game. Looks kind of interesting. I would never have bought it, though.
Right.
And then I got the Battleground Fantasy Warfare scenario book, which is something I was at least interested in.
So. Right, right. They've got at least some scenarios to do there. And they even came with some cards.
Yeah, there were some cards in there, too.
Some cards to cut out in there. Yeah, so I managed to get a bunch of things that really aren't worth talking about because I'm not going to keep them. Some of them I'm giving away. A lot of them were party game type games. That was what a lot was left. And I'm giving those to my party game loving friends.
Well, that's nice of you.
Well, you know, hey.
Cost you nothing.
I like to think of it as passing along the win, the joy, the love to somebody else, not ditching something that I didn't have to pay for.
Definitely.
That's the not nice way of saying it.
I didn't mean that. That's good. You're giving it to someone who will appreciate it more than you.
That's right. Hey, very good. I like that.
You're maximizing happiness in the world.
There you go. I am maximizing happiness, and I was happy to do so. So the dealer's room was fun. I bought some stuff. I'm happy to get the hero card games that we can play, both Orc Wars and Nightmare.
Yeah, we should.
And I'm
going to
try
those.
Space Station Assault.
We should play those and review them in a future podcast.
Everything is fodder for future podcast reviews. Yes,
that's right.
And we'll be sure to talk about them. And that's what I had from the dealer's room.
All right, cool. Well, that was fun. So that was KublaCon. That's it for our KublaCon 2008 show. If you went to KublaCon, leave a comment on the blog and tell us what you thought. Or even if you didn't and you have some reaction to what we were talking about, leave us a message.
If you have an opinion about KublaCon, even if you've never been, feel free.
I know we both had a great time, and we can't wait for next year. So,
yep.
And that's probably when our next podcast will be. Well, let's hope not.
Yes.
All right, see y'all later. Well, thanks for listening to us jibber-jabber on about our yearly convention adventures. Do you have some thoughts to share with us? If you do, feel free to leave us a comment on this podcast's entry at roll2d6.com or send us email at roll2d6@gmail.com.
We always love to get feedback, so feel free to sound off at the site. If you like what you hear, tell your friends to listen to the show, or leave a review of Roll2D6 on your favorite podcast review site, or create a dozen Roll2D6 crop circles in the English countryside.
That's right, yeah. Free t-shirt for the first person who makes Roll2D6's logo visible from space, or at least on Google Earth.
And we're serious about that.
Yes, I am serious. If someone does that, I'm at the t-shirt shop. All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2d6 times n days, or maybe weeks, when you'll hear Nate say...